Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
It's time for our first guest now, and at the age of 17, Natalie Collins's life changed when she found herself in a coercive and abusive relationship. 15 years later, she's put her story into a book called Out of Control, where she also gives advice to others who may find themselves in a difficult position. Great to have you on the show, Natalie.
Hi.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Wonderful. Now, you said that you've tried to make this book quite lighthearted, but it's not a lighthearted subject, is it?
Well, no. When I originally wrote the proposal for this book, I thought I didn't really know what tone it was going to take. And then as I actually started to write the first chapter, I realised that my tone was actually very lighthearted. And it is a really difficult subject. And so it's important that we find ways to make it accessible to people. And I've run programs for hundreds and hundreds of women over the last decade. And one of the things that has made it possible for us to engage with these really difficult topics and to start realizing what's gone on in our own lives is to find ways to laugh and have fun and not become overly, dragged down by the horror of it all.
Yeah, it is true what they say, out of something bad comes something good, and nobody would have wished, you know, what happened to you to anyone, but you've turned it around and now you're helping others, which I think is great.
Yeah. I think it's I saw this quote the other day that was about the terrible things that happen in our lives are always going to be awful and they're always going to be bad, a bit like compost. The compost is always going to be horrid, but it has the potential, if it's used in the right way, to grow something beautiful out of it.
Oh,
that's, I think that's something that,
yeah,
I think is positive.
That's a great quote. Well, if you don't mind, we'll just go through your story. You grew up in what you say was a very Christian home, and you were very evangelistic as a teenager. So you believed in no sex before marriage, presumably.
Yeah, so growing up I was born in the north of England and grew up in a conservative Christian home, and there was a lot of love and a lot of positive things about that. I think anybody who's grown up in a faith community will recognise that there's good things and bad things about that, and being part of a community where there's adults and children that you get to spend a lot of time with is really positive. But it did mean I developed some really problematic understandings of sex and relationships. So as you say, within the dominant Christian understanding of sex is that you shouldn't have sex before marriage. And so at 17, that was very much how I saw myself being a Christian, by rejecting this kind of very cultural attitude that having lots of sex was the way to have a good life. And and so at 17, when I met a boy he was saying that he wanted to move into doing sexual stuff, and I just thought all I had to do is say no. If I just say no and have sex, that'll be fine. And the problem is when we tell young people that, you know, no sex before marriage or that kind of stuff, what we do is one of the messages I got as a young person was that sex is like a chocolate cake. You should keep it in the fridge and stay out of the kitchen. But the problem is that doesn't give much framework for young people to work out, well, have they chosen to go into the kitchen and start eating the chocolate cake, or has someone dragged them into the kitchen and shoved their face in the chocolate cake?
Right, yeah.
Which was very much, the latter was very much my experience, that I, the boy that I met, Within weeks, he'd manipulated me into sleeping with him. And I look back now and I can see that he was very coercive, he was very manipulative, he was very controlling and intense. But at the time, I didn't have any framework to understand that. All I knew was, if you say you don't have sex, that's all you need to do. He also was somebody who had recently become a Christian. And the other thing that I'd learned in church was, you know, you only have relationship with opposite sex Christians.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you don't need to check if they're a good person or if they're going to be nice to you. Just if they pray the same prayers as you. And so I I didn't really ask enough questions or understand what he was like. And by that point, within a few weeks, I'd slept with him and that was it. Then I thought, well, this is it. This is my life, because the only way to fix this is to stay with him forever, basically.
So this boy who claimed to be a Christian, he didn't have the same philosophy as there shouldn't be sex before marriage, even though he was supposed to be a Christian.
Yeah, well, this is it. And it emerged very quickly. He wasn't actually...
Oh, he wasn't a Christian.
He'd recently kind of engaged with faith. And I think that he, when I met him, I'd met him through friends. He said he was a Christian. So I thought that was true. But it emerged that it was a very sort of superficial commitment that emerged very quickly that actually he was very dangerous.
Yeah. And is this the boy that eventually became your husband?
Yeah, so he refused to use contraception. So within 6 months, I was pregnant.
And, wow.
I'd grown up in a family where my parents read one of the newspapers in the UK, which said that the pill was going to give me cancer. So they were like quite anti the pill. And then I'd gone to a Catholic school where we didn't learn about contraception. So all those things together didn't really make it very realistic for me to be practicing safe sex, if you like. And he wouldn't use contraception. It's something that often a lot of people are not aware of, is that it's called reproductive coercion. It's when usually men will coerce their partner into types of sex that would potentially lead to them being pregnant. It might involve pricking holes in condoms. It might be about trying to convince someone onto the pill and off like an implant or other long-term contraceptive method. I worked with one woman and she used to have to stick the contraceptive pill to the underside of the outside of her windowsill so that he wouldn't discover she was taking it, because he would have assaulted her. And so a lot of the time there's kind of this idea that lots of women get themselves pregnant to trap men. In reality, the much more dominant reality is that there are men who will coerce women into pregnancy to control them, which is what happened to me.
Yeah, very interesting.
So at 18, I was pregnant at 17 and married him at 18 then, because, well, that's what you need to do, isn't it? When you have a baby with someone, you need to create a stable environment for that child.
Yeah. So he sort of coerced you into that. You got married, you had the baby. Was everything rosy from then on then, or did he have a hidden agenda?
Yeah, I think one of the things that often people presume is that somebody can stop being abusive just overnight. And pregnancy is a huge risk factor for abuse. In the UK, about 25% of women will be subjected to abuse. That's across most Western countries, we're looking at about that rate. So 25% of women. And pregnancy is a risk factor where an abuser is much more likely to perpetrate violence during pregnancy. People often are quite shocked at that because they think, wow, pregnancy, it should be, you should be looking after your partner.
Gosh,
but somebody who's abusive isn't really interested in supporting their partner. They're interested in getting what they want. And when somebody's pregnant, they're less able to do what their partner wants. So it's a really difficult situation. I've got this small child, and what pregnancy and having a baby does is it enables us to be much more easily controlled, because we don't want to, we have lots of societal messages that say that single mothers are some sort of, terrible people, and that they've failed in some way. And so actually that societal message drove me to think, well, I need to stay in this relationship. I need to make it work. My faith was a part of that. And also just wider societal messages of romance. There's this kind of idea that love should be something which defies all logic. And so when we're in a relationship with someone who's controlling us, who's damaging us in lots of different ways, we think, well, the fact that I'm still here and I still love him must mean that this is really true love, a bit like Beauty and the Beast. He locks her in a tower and then she falls in love with him. So it's a message about relationships we've heard a lot. And so I married him and his abuse and control just escalated. The reality is that abusers don't just change out of the blue. Most abusers don't ever change. They just go from one relationship to another relationship being abusive. And there's an escalation, because what works at the beginning to keep someone controlled doesn't continue to work all the way through. And so they have to continue to increase the abusive behaviour to keep that control there.
And are we talking psychological abuse or physical abuse?
So the majority of the time he wasn't physically violent. There were a few occasions in which he was, but a lot of it was about isolating me from family and friends. It was about being very sexually abusive, forcing me to do things sexually which were really unpleasant, and that I felt like I had to do because otherwise he'll do it with consent, and somehow by wanting to do it, I'll somehow make it less awful. He would be very, he wouldn't support me as a parent. So when I had my daughter, he just wouldn't do anything for her. He wouldn't support the housework. He didn't do it. You know, he wasn't a partner. He very much, I had to do everything. He was very abusive in the words that he'd use for me. He'd use lots of really offensive language that I probably can't say at this time on the radio to describe me and to speak about me. I became totally a shell of myself. I thought that I was worth nothing, that I was stupid, stupid, ugly and fat, and that everything that he did wrong was my fault. And the other thing that an abuser will do is always avoid responsibility for any of their choices. And so they'll very much blame their partner until we actually believe it's our fault. He will blame, you know, his childhood or drug or alcohol or whatever else is going on, rather than take responsibility. And so I ended up feeling it was all my fault, and I became increasingly depressed. I ended up on antidepressants. You know, doctors treated me for my issues, and I had to continue to go home and live with my issue, continue being married to this issue. By the time we were both 19, he'd begun, he'd regularly cheated on me with other women. And by the time we were 19, he was convicted of sex offences against teenage girls for beginning sexual relationships with teenage girls.
Dear. Oh, how awful. This, I know that you mentioned you grew up as a Christian. Did this shake your faith at all?
Well, the thing that an abuser does is they strip us of anything that gives us confidence, that anything that gives us strength. So that's one of the reasons they will isolate us from family and friends, because those friends and family will give us strength. And similarly with faith, that an abuser will strip faith of any power to heal us or support us, while using faith as a weapon to make us do what he wants. And so I had this sense that I have to forgive him, and I just have to forget everything he does, and if I just love him enough, then that will make everything okay, and he will then become a Christian and it'll be lovely. And had this kind of idea that if I could just give enough of myself and love enough, that would solve everything. And I think that's a message a lot of women believe, and most of our lives as girls and women, we're socialized to believe that if we just give enough and if we just love enough, then that's what is required of us. So sadly, for a long time, faith was a weapon to beat me and stripped of that liberatory quality that lots of people experience from faith.
Yeah. So the good news is you did get away from him. And how did you do that? Because I can imagine, you know, you've lost your confidence, you've got a young child, you know, you have to be very brave to get yourself up and walk out.
Yeah, and I did. And that's not how it happened. So, you know, people listening now might be thinking, oh, you know, she sounds very, you know, confident and articulate and all those things. And the reality is that I didn't suddenly wake up one day and think, this is wrong and I need to leave. When I was, I became pregnant with my son. And when I was 6 months pregnant, my then husband assaulted me, and my son was born 3 months premature.
Oh, no.
And so we ended up being moved to a hospital about an hour from my hometown. And me and my daughter, who was 2.5 at the time, and my son, who was, he was 2.6 when he was born, and he was on a ventilator for quite a long time. So we ended up moving and living in a hospital, and we were in that hospital for 5 months. And it was that physical separation of being in a place an hour away that physically forced me to have to start to create some distance, and seeing how he behaved and seeing that my son being so ill in hospital was a direct consequence of his behaviour were the things that led me to think, actually, there needs to be some consequences. And lots of women will talk about this, that he could do anything to them, but when he hurts the children, I know one woman who left when he assaulted her mother, and she never went back again. And so a combination of physically having to be in a different place and also seeing the impact that he'd had on my child led me to report him to the police for that. And that was the beginning of me starting to separate and properly move on.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, it's awful, obviously, what happened to your son, but it gave you the strength. Presumably, by that time, you could get support from family and friends because they were able to visit you and you were able to get in touch with them.
Yeah, so it's one of those tricky things that the way that somebody isolates us and controls us in that way, it's often very subtle. So, you know, we don't realise that we haven't really got a relationship with our family or friends anymore. And obviously we were living in a hospital an hour from my hometown, so my family were involved as much as they were able to be. And then I chose to move when my son got released from intensive care. I chose to move even further away, another hour away, because I knew that if I went back to my hometown, I'd end up back in the relationship. And one of the things is that actually to get free, I had to, in some ways, move further away from my family and friends. So that was a tricky thing. But obviously, I wasn't then dealing with somebody intentionally trying to isolate me. So I was able to reestablish those relationships and gain support in that situation as well.
Yeah. Well as the book, I know you now run workshops. We will give you a website out at the end to help raise awareness. Because a lot of us, I don't think, realise what actually constitutes abuse. You know, you think a woman being hit or even a man being hit, you think, well, they're being abused. But like you say, there's psychological abuse, there's coercive abuse. It's a massive, massive thing.
Yeah, definitely. And also looking at things like how finances can be used. So when I was with my ex-husband, he would control the finances, not by being responsible for them, but expecting me to manage all the finances, but then spending all the money. And so it felt like I was in control of the finances because I had to work out how do we budget enough to survive. But actually, he would be spending all the money. And lots of women will talk about how their partner got loans out in their name or got them into lots of debt. So that can make it really difficult to leave. And within the book, I talk about 8 different characteristics of an abuser, and they include humiliating us, and that might be sexually or degrading us sexually, but it also might be about laughing at us in front of other people or making jokes about us that leave us feeling really shriveled up inside. You know, we've already talked a lot about isolation, about threatening us. I worked with a woman, and she came to a session with me, and she said, something weird happened this morning. My partner, he's lying next to me on the bed, and he started stroking my neck, and he just said in a really nice voice that, you know, if I ever left him, that he would slit my throat. Which is horrifying, but in the context, you know, the context and the subtext of this situation made what he said sound very, you know, jarring, and so she couldn't really make sense of it. So a lot of the time, the threats are not kind of saying, I'm going to kill you in an aggressive tone. Mm. It's threatening to do stuff, but not doing it in a way where we're hearing what's actually being said.
Yeah.
Exhausting us is another tactic, so making us stay up late at night to talk about their feelings, wanting to go out for a walk, wanting to, if they do a nighttime job, they're then expecting us to be up and on the phone to them all night. And if we're exhausted, as anybody who's had small children knows, it makes it very difficult if you're exhausted to make good decisions. And so keeping us exhausted, demanding things of us. The brainwasher is the one who will keep all the attention on them, who will try to stop us having anybody else but them to think about what's going on. The brainwasher will also do things like he might move things or hide things. And so we think, oh, have you seen my keys? And they'll say, oh, no, I haven't seen them, when actually they've hidden them. And suddenly we think we're going mad, because who in their right mind thinks, oh, my partner's making me think I'm going mad? And then obviously there is physical violence or sexual violence, which is the sharp end of that situation. But even when there's any physical violence, often when we're in a situation with somebody like this, we'll still think, oh no, it's not abuse, it's only very occasional. And then the other type of abuse is actually when somebody's really, really nice to us. And it's not about saying that being nice to someone's abusive, but when it comes alongside all these tactics, if it was awful all the time, we would probably go. But it's not awful all the time, and sometimes, you know, it's about keeping this hope that things can get better. You know, I often explain when I'm doing training and speaking at events that if somebody if somebody didn't let us go to the toilet for 24 hours and then they let us go to the toilet, we wouldn't say, how dare you not let me go to the toilet? We'd say, oh, thank you so much
for letting
me go. Because suddenly, when people strip us of everything, the tiniest crumb they give us takes on epic proportions. And so it's really difficult, because lots of people might be listening to this and thinking, oh, actually, I recognize that in a previous relationship, but they don't want to use the label abuse, or in a current relationship, and they don't want to label this as abuse, because that's a really scary word.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's true. And you often hear of people, don't you, and you being abused, whether it's physical or psychological, and afterwards the abuser says, I'm so sorry, it'll never happen again. And you want to believe that it won't happen again.
Well, this is it, because actually we've invested so much in the relationship. We love this person. You know, no abuser turns up on the first date and says, I'm going to make your life miserable forever. you know, they don't have a tattoo which says abuser on their forehead. They all look very different. They're from every part of society. Some are very wealthy. Some don't have any money. You know, some are gay. You know, there is no kind of place where you can go, well, oh, well, I'll never find an abuser here. And so by the time we realize that this is making us unhappy, we're usually too far in. There's a term called love bombing, which was originally used to describe the ways that cults recruit new cult members, but it can also be used to describe how somebody gets somebody to start a relationship. And it's about being very intense, wanting to spend all their time with them, wanting to move to greater commitment very quickly. We can probably all think of situations where we know a relationship that's moved into engagement or moving in, or kids, very, very quickly. I mean, it's not a case of saying that's always abuse, but it's definitely a big sign for me if somebody's committing very quickly to very intensive relationships. And so being aware of that is very difficult, because by the time we then are starting to be able to think about what's going on, we've already committed very much. And they deliberately try to be so intense that we don't have time to think. We don't have time to think rationally. And often, as I said before, societal messages, romantic comedies, all of those things are sending a message. Wow, if this love is all consuming and so intense, it must be real, rather than maybe it's dangerous.
yeah. It's interesting stuff. And I was reading some statistics that apparently over the course of a lifetime, 30% of women and 16% of men, because we mustn't forget it happens to men as well, will be subjected to abuse by a partner. They're really quite high statistics, sadly.
Well, this is it. There's research done in the UK that found that 72% of girls will be subjected to emotional abuse by the time they're 16. So among young people, it's even greater than the data that we're finding around how many people are subjected to abuse. And absolutely, men can be abused and women can be abusive. The vast majority of men who are abused in same-sex relationships. So the perpetrator is often still male.
Yeah. Well, the book is called Out of Control, Couples, Conflict and the Capacity for Change by Natalie Collins, who we're speaking to now. It's filled with case studies, including Natalie's own story, and lots of advice, much needed advice to address domestic abuse. And your website, Natalie, what's your website?
It's nataliecollins.info. If you Google me, you can probably find me there too.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. You've been so open and honest about your story, and I'm sure it's going to help somebody out there. So thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.